Good morning, church family. We started this year, the year of our Lord, 2024, with this new sermon series where we are looking at some of the tough questions that get asked. And I feel like this is just such an important series for our church, for every church through the centuries. And the first reason is this. We, especially at Stonebridge, but I think for the whole church, it should be safe, normal, and appropriate to ask questions in the church family. It should feel safe to ask questions. It should feel safe to say things to one another. Now, this is not a place where we feel safe, where we can ask questions, even tough questions, maybe questions that someone you may think may not like. If this is not a safe place to ask questions, then we are not being a pursuer of the truth, who is Jesus himself. And so I can't stress this enough. Don't keep questions and doubts to yourself. We make it a priority here at Stonebridge. This is a place where you can ask questions without any feeling of shame, without any fear. Because this is how you live in this one way, anyways, to live in the light. It's another way to grow in your faith. You can't grow if there is a question, if there is a doubt, and we long to see people grow in their faith. And doubts and questions are things that can stop us from growing until we work through them. And usually when you work through them, your faith becomes so much stronger because you've analyzed the evidence for yourself. I ask questions all the time, can ask questions all the time. If we claim to care about truth, then we pursue truth, and questions are how we get to a deeper understanding of reality. And the second reason why it's so important to do series like this in a church to deal with tough questions is because there is a lot of bad information out there. Anyone can make a TikTok or an Instagram video, but that doesn't mean it's true. I'm sure the reality is that probably all of you, if not all of us, have come across things online that are critical of Christianity, and we do not want to be left in the dark. Now, it is true. Some people do ask tough questions in good faith because they're genuinely curious and pursuing answers, but there are a whole lot of people who say things that are deliberately deceitful. And either way, we have a pastoral responsibility as a church to protect the church from false teaching and false teachers. If you come across things in your life, if you find yourself on some YouTube channel or whatever it is that makes you wonder about Jesus or something about the Bible or anything, if there's something that makes you wonder, ask the question. We're going to keep continuing this series for a little bit. We haven't put like an end date on or anything like that. And so I just want to make an open invitation. If there's a tough question or if there's a doubt in your life that you wonder about, write it on our response card, put it in the blue box in the foyer, and we might get to it in a sermon series. And if we don't get to it in the sermon series, we will get back to you personally. We care about the truth. And it's not that we think here at Stonebridge, the teaching team knows all the answers to everything. We don't know everything. But I'll give you this promise. We care about the truth, and we care about people, and we care about the questions people ask. And so we want to be a church where it is normal and safe, and that we can be the type of people that pursue the truth, pursue how reality really is, and any questions or doubts that come along the way are just vehicles to help us pursue truth together. And so Ken has already looked at some tough questions. If you want to go back in the series, we talked about judgment, we've talked about hell. And last week, Ken looked at this question, is Jesus the only way to God? And Ken began to answer this question by looking at the claims of Jesus. Who did Jesus say that he was? What actions did Jesus take that confirmed the claims that he made? And I don't know about you, but if you were here or if you're online, you saw just verse after verse after verse flying through the screen. 193 PowerPoint slides. We looked at it later. So many Bible verses. And the whole point of doing that is to investigate the truth. Who is Jesus? And as Ken clearly showed us, he claimed not just to be some charismatic leader. He claimed not just to have some spiritual insight, or he had some revelation from God, or some angel told him some things, or he found some writings hidden in a cave. No, he claimed he was God himself in the flesh. And he took actions that only God can do. That outside of every other human being that has ever lived on this planet, Jesus stands unique because he's not just a human. He is truly God in the flesh. And so what I want to do this morning is look on the other side of the coin. That's not just the claims of Jesus or the claims that Jesus said and then did and proved in his actions. It is what you could say, the work of Christ. So if we've got, this is who Jesus is or who he says he is. Now the other big area is say, what did Jesus do? What is the work of Christ that reveals he is God? And the answer is the resurrection. I want to look at the resurrection this morning. Why study the resurrection as a part of a tough question series, because if the resurrection really happened and Jesus walked out of that grave, then all the claims Jesus made are true. That if the resurrection happened, Christianity is true. In some sense, all our eggs are in this basket. The resurrection is the linchpin of Christianity. If you know wheels, linchpin's the thing in the middle that holds it all together. And that this is what Christianity is completely dependent on. The claims about a historical event that happened in the first century AD. Listen to what Paul writes in 1 Corinthians 15, 13 through 14. If there is no resurrection of the dead, then not even Christ has been raised. And if Christ has not been raised, our preaching is useless, and so is your faith. Now, this has been Christianity from the beginning. We fully admit we hang everything on the resurrection. And unlike every other religion, you've probably heard me say this before, this is not some writings that were found or something that can't be tested. These are real claims about what happened in history, questions where you can actually test them historically. Unlike every other faith out there, except for Judaism, which would make sense because Christianity is the fulfillment of God's promises from the beginning. And so is our faith useless? No, because Jesus really rose from the dead. And this gives me so much confidence. And I want to be completely transparent this morning. I struggle with doubts and questions too. I have doubts that creep in my mind. There are questions, there are critiques of Christianity that sometimes make me wonder. But the evidences for the existence of God and the resurrection of Jesus are so strong that there's no way that a doubt about something secondary is ever going to tip the scales over what is primary. I say this truly. I go to sleep confident because of the resurrection. And in the areas where I doubt or I have questions, I'm pursuing those, and often those get resolved because there's good answers out there. But the reality is, even if I'm struggling with a question, I can sleep confidently knowing, yes, Jesus rose from the dead, and he is alive and well. And so this morning, I want us to look at the resurrection because I want you to be confident in your faith. I want to look at the resurrection so that when doubts and questions pop in your mind, you have a firm foundation in Jesus because he really did rise from the dead. And if Jesus really did rise from the dead, then his claims are true, and we better follow him wholeheartedly. So why do we trust the resurrection? That's what we're looking at today. And I want to say this, because it's the only answer that makes sense of the data. When you ask a question about the past, you have to use the tools of history. For instance, if you want to know who was the first president of the United States, you're not going to find that answer in a science lab. Doesn't matter how many tests you run, you are never going to get an answer to a historical question in a science lab because that's not the field of inquiry. And so we have to use the tools of history to learn what happened in the past. How do you do that? You look at things like eyewitness testimony, recorded documents. You compare them against each other. You look for multiple sources, multiple attestation, meaning multiple people are talking about the same thing. And when we see this in the studies of history, we can be fairly confident or even really confident about what happened in history. Now, this is the field of historical discovery. How do we want to know what happens in the past? We got to look at records and eyewitness accounts and compare them to one another. So I want to share with you this morning what's called the minimal facts argument for the resurrection. Now, this is something that a professor named Gary Habermas has spent his entire life on. And I find this particular strain of argumentation extremely helpful, not only to strengthen your own faith personally, but also so that you can engage and talk with others about the truth of Christianity. And so what is the minimal facts argument? It is this. What are the minimal facts that basically every New Testament scholar and every historian agrees happened in the first century? Again, just the minimal facts. What are just the baseline facts that basically if you go to the field of history at any university, the majority of the professors are going to agree with these basic minimal facts. Or if you go in the field of New Testament studies, which is a big field that's way bigger than the church, a lot of non-Christians in the field of New Testament studies, what do they say, even if they don't believe in Jesus or believe in God, what do they say happened in history according to the events recorded in the Bible? And so Gary Habermas, he's a professor at Liberty University. He has spent the last 50 years researching this one question. His goal, I want the entire church for the rest of history to be blessed by my work on the resurrection. That's his goal. He's almost 80 years old. He's writing a 4,000-page work defending the resurrection. If you want to buy it, it's very expensive. I probably won't be buying it, so I just listen to his lectures. But he says this, his minimal facts argument, that over 80% of all scholars, Christian or not Christian, in the field of New Testament studies or in the fields of history, they will claim six things happened in the first century. And again, these vast majority of these people are not Christians who do not believe the Bible is the inerrant word of God. But they will admit these six things are true. Even if the Bible has a lot of falsehood in it, they'll say these six things happened. And so, let's work through them. Because if these six minimal facts are true, then there's only one plausible conclusion. Jesus rose from the dead. And so this is minimal fact number one, basically agreed on by every historian. It's almost 100% that Jesus died due to the effects of Roman crucifixion. Now, this is one of the most verifiable facts in all the studies of history about what happened in the first century, because it's talked about all across ancient documents. And so let's read it. Mark, I'm going to read a lot of Bible, and then we'll talk about it. And so let's read this story in Mark 15, 27 through 37. They crucified two rebels with him, one on his right and one on his left. Those who passed by hurled insults at him, shaking their heads and saying, "So, you who are going to destroy the temple and build it in 3 days, come down from the cross and save yourself." In the same way, the chief priests and the teachers of the law mocked him among themselves. "He saved others," they said, "but he can't save himself. Let this Messiah, this King of Israel, come down now from the cross that we may see and believe." Those crucified with him also heaped insults on him. At noon, darkness came over the whole land until 3 p.m. And at 3 p.m, Jesus cried out in a loud voice, "Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani," which means, my God, why have you forsaken me?" When some of those standing near, heard this, they said, "Listen, he's calling Elijah." Someone ran, filled a sponge with wine vinegar, put it on a staff, and offered it to Jesus to drink. "Now leave him alone. Let's see if Elijah comes to take him down," he said. With a loud cry, Jesus breathed his last. So that is the recording of the account of the death of Jesus in the Gospel of Mark. And again, I'm not going to argue today for the validity of every single part of that story. Let's just set aside everything else. We'll set aside the two rebels on his right and the left. We'll set aside the darkness over the land. We'll set aside the words and the wine vinegar and everything that happened. I believe they're all true. I hold the Bible inerrant. Don't get me wrong. But just for the sake of the minimal facts, what is the one thing that everybody agrees in that story? There's no debate. And it's that last line. Jesus breathed his last. Jesus died on a Roman cross. Every scholar, every historian says, yeah, that really happened in history. In the first century AD, some guy named Jesus of Nazareth died on a Roman cross. You've got four different historical accounts in the Gospels. We've got a couple non-biblical accounts in different writings of other historians from the first century, and they all agree. Jesus died on a Roman cross, and he died by crucifixion. Everybody says that's true. Minimal fact number one. All right, minimal fact number two. The disciples had experiences that they believed to be the appearance of the risen Jesus. And I hope you just hear the conservative nature of that claim. They just believed they had an appearance of the risen Jesus. Not saying they actually saw the risen Jesus, but they just believed that. The vast wide swath of historians and scholars believe this to be true. And the New Testament records 12 different times, 12 different places in the New Testament where Jesus appeared to his followers after his death. I just want to read two. Obviously, it's coming from Scripture. Matthew 28, 8 through 10, the first appearance. So the women hurried away from the tomb. This is after the angels talked to them. They hurried away from the tomb, afraid yet filled with joy, and ran to tell his disciples. Suddenly, Jesus met them. "Greetings," he said. They came to him, clasped his feet, and worshipped him. Then Jesus said to them, "Do not be afraid. Go and tell my brothers to go to Galilee. There they will see me." So here are the women. They've left the tomb. They've been told by the angel Jesus had risen. And then Jesus shows up. The very first people to see the risen Jesus are these women, his women followers. And then now let's just read the account of the 12 disciples, the 12 apostles in John 20. Now Thomas, also known as Didymus, one of the 12, was not with the disciples when Jesus came. So the other disciples told him, "We have seen the Lord." But he said to them, "Unless I see the nail marks in his hands and put my finger where the nails were and put my hand in his side, I will not believe." A week later, his disciples were in the house again, and Thomas was with them. Though the doors were locked, Jesus came and stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." Then he said to Thomas, "Put your finger here, see my hands, reach out your hand and put it in my side. Stop doubting and believe. Thomas said to him, my Lord and my God. Then Jesus said, because you have seen me, you have believed. Blessed are those who have not seen and yet believed. And again, here's an account in the New Testament of the 12 disciples, the 12 apostles. 11 of them have already seen him once. Thomas wasn't there. And now Thomas also gets to see Jesus for the first time. Now, again, I hold all of those accounts to be true in their entirety. Everything happened just as was described there in Matthew and in John. But what is the minimal fact that all scholars, or the majority of scholars, wide majority of scholars, and wide majority of historians will agree to be true? Those people at least thought they had an appearance of the risen Jesus, right? They won't claim that it was actually Jesus, but let's just say, yeah, they at least thought, or they thought they had this experience or this vision or this hallucination of Jesus coming. And that's fine. That's okay. We're just going to put that on the table. We'll accept that minimal fact for the purposes of arguments. Number three, the disciples' lives were totally transformed and they were willing to die for Jesus. Matthew 26, 69 through 75 says this. Now Peter was sitting out in the courtyard and a servant girl came to him. You also were with Jesus of Galilee, she said. But he denied it before them all. I don't know what you're talking about, he said. Then he went out to the gateway where another servant girl saw him and said to the people there, this fellow was with Jesus of Nazareth. He denied it again with an oath. I don't know the man. After a little while, those standing there went up to Peter and said, surely you are one of them. Your accent gives you away. Then he began to call down curses and he swore to them, I don't know the man. And immediately the rooster crowed. And so this is a famous story. But this is Peter denying Jesus. Three different denials leading up to the cross. Why does Peter deny it? Because he knows that if he claims to be with the guy that's on trial right now, he's going to be lumped in right with them. And scared for his life, he tells a lie. He rejects any knowledge. He disavows any knowledge of relationship with Jesus to save his own skin. And then here is Peter a few months later. Acts 4, 1 through 3, and then verse 13. The priests and the captain of the guard and the Sadducees came up to Peter and John while they were speaking to the people. They were greatly disturbed because the apostles were teaching the people, proclaiming in Jesus, here it is, the resurrection of the dead. They seized Peter and John, and because it was evening, they put them in jail until the next day. And we're going to skip ahead. This is the summary of the speech Peter gives. When they saw the courage of Peter and John and realized that they were unschooled, ordinary men, they were astonished and took note that these men had been with Jesus. Now, what is the minimal fact here? Again, historians may or may not reject everything that Acts says about history, but they will affirm that something happened in which the apostles at one time were scared and another time were fearless for Jesus. That there is some sort of change in that group of 12 plus Paul, group of 13, who something changed in their lives to make them from fearful to fearless. And that's just that will be accepted as a real event in history, that something changed in the lives of the disciples to the point that they were all willing to die. And you've probably heard every disciple lost their life for their faith. I don't think that's the best claim to make. It's possible, but historically speaking, it's hard to say there's good evidence that all 12 ended up dying for their faith. But certainly a lot did. For certainly Peter did. It's very clear that he died under Nero in around AD 66. He was crucified. And a lot of people say he was crucified upside down. Yeah, that's probably may not be accurate. It comes from a legendary book that we don't trust a lot of the other things it says, so it's hard to say that Peter was crucified upside down. But Peter was definitely crucified for his faith. And again, this is the pursuit of truth. We are pursuing truth. I don't want the legendary crazy stories just because they're fun to say. Like, we want truth because we follow a God of truth. And so what is the minimal fact? That certainly some of the apostles gave their lives quite brutally for Jesus. And as legend goes, they all did. But I never want to make a claim that I don't feel confident in. But something changed the lives of the apostles. Minimal fact number three that historians will agree on. Minimal fact number four. The resurrection was proclaimed very early. And this is actually much more, this is a huge claim that doesn't seem like a huge claim on the surface. So let me show you why scholars think this to be true. 1 Corinthians 15, 3 through 7. Says this. This is Paul writing, famous passage about the resurrection. He says this: for what I received, I passed on to you as of first importance, that Christ died for our sins according to the scriptures, that he was buried, that he was raised on the third day according to the scriptures, that he appeared to Cephas and then to the 12. After that, he appeared to more than 500 of the brothers and sisters at the same time, most of whom are still living, though some have fallen asleep. Then he appeared to James, then to all the apostles. And so this right here is a very famous passage in scripture. This is what we would call an early creed. And by creed, what I mean is like a memorable, easy to memorize slogan or statement that was very easy to like to teach others. And the reason why we think this is a creed, we're very confident this is a creed, is because of a lot of the elements in there. And so we read at the beginning, Paul says, "For what I received, I passed on to you." And that is actually very technical Jewish language, Jewish rabbinical language, in which the master or the rabbi passes on a sacred teaching that needs to be remembered perfectly to his student. This is the language that the ancient Jews would use. "For what I received, I passed." Very technical language, saying what I'm about to pass on to you is a very important thing that you memorize perfectly. Number two, he calls Peter Cephas. Now, Cephas is his birth name, his Jewish name, and Jesus changes his name to Peter. And it's only in the very earliest accounts that we see Peter called Cephas. And so anytime we see this older name being used, we know that the origination of that is coming from a very early time in history. And so this is telling us this is very old, because by the time 1 Corinthians was written, nobody was calling Cephas, no one was calling Peter Cephas anymore. And then number three, the New Testament is written in Greek, but this phrase, that what we just read, it's not properly worded Greek. And this is way above my pay scale. I only know the minimal things about Greek. But what scholars say who study linguistics for a living is that it's not proper grammar in Greek, but it is proper grammar in Aramaic. And it follows this fourfold pattern, which means someone is translating a pithy slogan from Aramaic, the common language of the day that Jews spoke, and they're translating into Greek, which reveals that this was not Paul writing it when he wrote 1 Corinthians. He is translating an Aramaic phrase into Greek because it is his creed that the church preached from the very beginning. And so where did Paul receive this, right? He said, for what I received, I passed on to you, sorry. And so Paul says this. When did he receive it? We know when he received it. Galatians 1, 15 through 19 says this. What was Paul writing again? "But when God, who set me apart from my mother's womb and called me by his grace, was pleased to reveal his son in me so that I might preach him among the Gentiles, my immediate response was not to consult any human being. I did not go to Jerusalem to see those who were the apostles before I was, but I went into Arabia. Later, I returned to Damascus. Then, after 3 years, I went up to Jerusalem to get acquainted with Cephas," there it is again, "and stayed with him 15 days. I saw none of the other apostles, only James, the Lord's brother." And so for the sake of time, let me just do some common dates that most scholars accept. Jesus' resurrection, or his death and resurrection, most likely is AD 33. That seems to be the best date. And then we know Paul was converted within 1 year on the Damascus Road. So that's probably later, AD 33, maybe AD 34. And then 3 years pass by, Paul just said it, and then he goes to Jerusalem and meets with Peter and James. And so by AD 36, 3 years after the resurrection, this pithy phrase, right, this creed has already been talked about, because this is the only time Paul could have ever received this creed. It's the only time he goes to Jerusalem to talk before he writes 1 Corinthians. That's not true. He goes another time. I don't have time to explain all of the. If you want to know the timeline of Paul, we can talk about it afterwards. But this would be the time that he received it. It's the only time that fits to receive this sort of message. And so what is the minimal fact? That from the very, very beginning, even if people want to date the New Testament being written way after the apostles, there is this ancient creed that talks about the resurrection of Jesus in 1 Corinthians 15 that was being spoken and sung possibly 3 years after the resurrection. And so what's that minimal fact? That from the very beginning, the church was preaching this story of resurrection. Whether or not it happened is up for debate, but they were talking about it all the time. It wasn't like it was invented 30 years after the time of Jesus. It was from the very beginning. And so minimal fact number five, the conversion of Paul. We just talked about it, but we'll jump a couple verses earlier in Galatians. Kind of, he tells the story of his life, verse 13. "For you have heard of my previous way of life in Judaism, how intensely I persecuted the church of God and tried to destroy it. I was advancing in Judaism beyond many of my own age among my people and was extremely zealous for the traditions of my fathers. But when God, who called me apart from my mother's womb and called me by his grace, was pleased to reveal his son in me so that I might preach him among the Gentiles, my immediate response was not to consult any human being. So this is minimal fact number five. Historians say is true, that there was this Jewish teacher named Saul who ended his life preaching under the name Paul for the sake of Jesus. That this is a very famous person. We take Paul for granted, but he studied under the tutelage of a man named Gamaliel in the first century. He is one of the most famous Jews in the history of Judaism in the first century. Like he was like the top academic, if you will, right? The authoritative voice of Judaism in the first century. And like Jews today, if you listen to modern Jews today, like Orthodox Jews, like they still quote Gamaliel. Like he was a big deal for Judaism. And that was Paul's teacher, right? He was, right, that was his mentor, the most famous teacher. So Paul, or Saul as he was then, like he is famous in the world of Judaism. And something happens to where he starts out persecuting Christians, dragging them off to jail and killing them. And something happens where he spends the last 40 years of his life proclaiming that that Jesus that he used to kill for, he is now saying he rose from the dead. And again, that's just the minimal fact that this very famous person or a very famous rabbi named Gamaliel, something happened and he converted from killing Christians to preaching the Christian message. And then lastly, minimal fact number six, that the brother of Jesus was also converted. And so just to show this in scripture, Mark 3:20-21, the story in scripture. Then Jesus entered a house, and again a crowd gathered so that he and his disciples were not even able to eat. When his family heard about this, they went to take charge of him, for they said, he is out of his mind. And then another story of Jesus and his brothers in John 7. After this, Jesus went around in Galilee. He did not want to go into Judea because the Jewish leaders there were looking for a way to kill him. But when the Jewish festival of Tabernacles was near, Jesus' brother said to him, leave Galilee and go to Judea so that the disciples there may see the works you do. No one who wants to become a public figure acts in secret. Since you are doing these things, show yourself to the world. For even his own brothers did not believe in him. And so here's the reality. Jesus' brothers thought he was out of his mind. Está loco. This guy was crazy. My brother is crazy. And some people in that John 7, I don't think this, but some people think that his brothers were trying to inadvertently kill their own brother. Jesus was bringing such dishonor on the family. It's like, yeah, go down there and hopefully they'll take care of you and we don't have to deal with the dishonor you're bringing on our family. I don't know if I'm that dark in my reading of that, but it's possible. But something happens because listen to the end of the story. Galatians 2:9. James, Cephas, and John, those esteemed as pillars, gave me and Barnabas the right hand of fellowship when they recognized the grace given to me. They agree. That's the rest of the verse. Not really applicable for what we're talking about there. But they go to the Gentiles. That's wonderful. Great. Praise the Lord. But for the purpose of today, in the minimal facts argument, something happens so that James becomes an esteemed pillar of the Jerusalem church. And you kind of read the whole New Testament, he seems to be kind of like the leader of the Jerusalem church, leader among the elders there. And so something happened in which James, the half-brother of Jesus, becomes a pillar in the church, in the Jerusalem church, the city where all of these events are claimed to have happened. And this is according to history. Again, it's attested by non-biblical sources that James was killed for his faith in the city of Jerusalem in the AD 60s. So this is the last minimal fact. Everyone agrees that Jesus, the half-brother of Jesus, didn't believe his brother, wasn't even at the cross when he died. And yet something happens so that he becomes the pillar and one of the leaders in the Jerusalem church and eventually gives his life for his half-brother. And then finally, I don't have a slide for it, but there's two more facts. These ones are still accepted by the majority of scholars, but not anywhere near that like 80% range. Gary Habermas calls these the almost minimal facts. And there are two things. One, that Jesus was buried in Joseph of Arimathea's tomb. Just there's a name on that tomb. And then secondly, that tomb was empty in Jerusalem in the first century. Now, I think that these are very credible historical events. And just not quite as many scholars, although still a majority of scholars, think these things are true. That Jesus was buried in a very famous man, Joseph of Arimathea's tomb. And something happened in which that tomb was found empty by everyone in the city. And so here's our minimal facts for this morning. What do we have? Jesus was killed. His disciples believed they saw him alive later. Something happened that transformed their lives, that they proclaimed that he was resurrected from the very beginning. That's the earliest message of Christianity. And that both an enemy of Christianity and a brother of this figure both converted from non-belief to belief because something happened in their lives. And so how do you make sense of all this data? What puts all these pieces together? Let's first entertain the conclusion that Jesus really didn't rise from the dead. That these six things are true, but there was actually no actual resurrection. You first have to explain why so many lives were changed. And the most common claim that is made is that they just had hallucinations or visions. And the definition of a hallucination or vision, right? You see something, your brain thinks it's seeing something, but it's not actually there. You couldn't reach out and actually touch it, although mentally you think you're perceiving something. And it's true. People have had hallucinations and visions all throughout history. This is a very well-documented psychological effect. The Bible even talks about visions, right? Peter has a vision of a sheet coming down. There's not actually a sheet in front of him, but he has a vision of it. So the Bible even affirms people have visions. Psychologists affirm this as well. But is this a good conclusion that all of these lives were changed? And the answer is no. Because although there's plenty of documented cases of hallucinations and visions, there are zero documentations of group hallucinations. And when Jesus appears to his followers, it's almost always in groups. We read two of them, right? He appeared to a bunch of women, or probably four women. He appeared to the 12 disciples and whoever else was in that room. That these are groups of people seeing Jesus. Groups of people where Jesus is saying, put your hands in the holes in my wrist and my feet. Put your hand in my side. Physically feel the thing that is happening. And this is happening in a group setting, not one-on-one. Happening to lots of people more than once. And he ate with them. They ate food together. They saw the empty plate. And so this possible conclusion that Jesus didn't rise from the dead doesn't make any sense for hallucinations, because there's no such thing as a group hallucination where everybody hallucinates the same thing. Not only that, but it doesn't even make sense in a Jewish worldview. Because remember, we're dealing with first century Jews who take the scriptures of the Jewish people extremely seriously. And the Jews, the overriding belief of the Jews in the first century is there is going to be a resurrection, and it's going to happen at the end. Daniel 12, 1 through 2 talks about this, and this was a common Jewish belief in the first century, is that God is going to show up at the end of all days, and then the final resurrection is going to happen. And so the idea of a resurrection happening that wasn't at the end of history wouldn't even make sense for a first century Jew. Now that idea would never cross their mind because they didn't think it could happen. How could someone resurrect from the dead in the middle of history, not at the end of history? The idea of one person resurrecting was completely foreign to their worldview. So how would they even come up with a claim like this? Because it doesn't even fit their Jewish worldview. And then skeptics will also claim that they stole this idea of dying and rising gods from other mythologies. You might have heard these before. They stole the story of Osiris, or they stole the story of Mithras. Those are the two that are most commonly batted around. But again, we're dealing with faithful Jewish people. They would have recoiled at the thought of the Egyptian and the Roman mythologies. These things were completely idolatrous. They would want nothing to do with them. And secondly, when you go back and read these stories, particularly of Osiris and Mithras, these are the two you'll always come across when someone claims the disciples just stole the story from someone else. But go read the story of Osiris. He is killed. It's Egyptian mythology. He was killed, and then he goes to be the god of the underworld, which is not a resurrection. He's still dead. His spirit's still living, but he's not coming back to life. He's just going to the underworld, the realm of the shadow, to guard the dead. And then Mithras is the same thing. He was a god who was killed, and he's still living in like the shadow realm, but he's not coming back to life. And the word for resurrection has nothing to do with like the existence of a soul continuing on. It has the idea of putting flesh back on, right? The soul is back in flesh. And secondly, Mithras, these stories of Mithras come after the time of Jesus, so they actually probably stole the story from Jesus. But these claims are not the same, because they are not stealing a story of a dying and rising God, because the idea that God would die and put flesh back on is foreign, not just to Jewish thinking, but to every thinking before what happened in the first century. No other supposed resurrection claim looks anything like the story of Jesus. But that's the claim, that Jesus put flesh back on. That's what resurrection is. This Greek word, anastasis, That's where the name Anastasia comes from. It means to put back on, right? To put flesh back on. You don't resurrect just because your soul continues on somewhere else, but you put flesh back on. And the Christian message is not that just flesh comes back on, but that flesh comes back on permanently, forever, with no problems ever again. And you live eternally in a perfect body that never decays. And so let's continue on. What are other things that people will say? Jesus really didn't rise from the dead. They'll say this: the disciples died for a lie. Maybe it was all just a big conspiracy. They wanted to create a lie that would perpetrate down through the centuries. Now, it is true. Lots of people die for a lie. Lots and lots of people throughout history have died for a lie. But this story would not be someone dying for a lie. They would be dying to create a lie. Because you see the difference? They're not getting the story secondhand. They're not told some story and they believe it so strongly that they're willing to die for it. They would be creating a lie and then giving their life to make sure that lie and that conspiracy is perpetrated on. They would have to hold this lie, this conspiracy, for the rest of their lives, going through so much persecution, pain, suffering, and death in the most inhumane ways without a single person recanting. That is incredibly hard to believe. Los Angeles' premier cold case detective, this guy has solved so many cold cases for the LA police, J. Warner Wallace, he said that there's three main motivations for humans. That when you look at a cold case, when you're trying to figure out motive, there's only three things that motivate people to do things: money, sex, or power. And the disciples got none of those things. They didn't get any money. Jesus has the most stringent sexual ethic in history, and they got absolutely no power because most of them died in very inhumane ways. They would have no motive. No reason to perpetrate this lie, this conspiracy, because they're not getting anything out of it, because it leads to the persecution and death. I love what Chuck Colson said. If you know Chuck Colson, I think he's with the Lord now. He ran Prison Fellowship. It's a ministry that outreaches to people in prison. And the reason he started this is because he used to be an atheist who didn't believe in God. And he was a part of Richard Nixon's campaign, who got charged and tried for what happened at Watergate. And Chuck Colson said this. He said, 10 of the most powerful men in the United States government couldn't keep the conspiracy of Watergate for more than 3 weeks before the whole thing fell apart. And yet you want me to believe that 12 men perpetrated a conspiracy for 40 years, not a single person recanting? I can't believe that, because we couldn't even keep this Watergate scandal going on for more than 3 weeks. That it is almost impossible to get a group of people to hold the conspiracy all the way through the end. And yet the disciples do it. And then finally, here is the piece that gives me so much comfort. As the tomb was found empty, think about the minimal facts that most historians accept to be true. There was a guy. He had a following. He died in the city of Jerusalem. Then his followers, 3 days later, claimed they saw him, claimed they touched him. They said that he didn't stay dead, but that he rose from the dead. And then they immediately start preaching that message in the very town where that death happened. What would you do if you didn't believe them? If you lived in Jerusalem, these men start preaching about this Jesus who rose from the dead. What would you do in a town that is really not that big? You would walk the 100 yards it is to the grave where he was buried to see where the body was. I mean, I use this as an example, but imagine if someone today in Los Angeles was saying the World Trade Center towers are still standing. If there was no media, you could probably get that floated around for a while in Los Angeles. But imagine if you lived in Manhattan and someone said the World Trade Centers are still standing. All you do is like, no, they're not. They're right there. And that's the same thing that's happening with the message of Christianity. The earliest followers are making these claims in the very town where they claim Jesus rose from the dead. And if the body was still there, all you'd have to do is go point and say, it's right there. We know where the grave is. We know where the grave is today. The Church of the Holy Sepulchre, if you go to Israel, like that's where the tomb was, Joseph of Arimathea's tomb. The tomb was empty, and you've got to have an explanation of why the tomb was empty. And so what are the only two possible explanations? Either someone moved the body, or someone walked out of the grave. And we've already talked about this. The Jewish followers of Jesus, they were not expecting, they had no concept of a middle of the world, in the middle of world history, someone resurrecting from the dead. Why would they create a story which they have no precedent for? Not only that, they have to create this lie and this conspiracy when all it brings about is pain, suffering, torture, imprisonment, and death. That strains imagination. But not only that, they would have to summon the courage to to come out of hiding, which we know they were hiding, they would have to confront a Roman guard. They would have to steal the body. Not only steal the body, they'd have to roll a stone, a very heavy stone, out of the way first. They'd have to steal the body. They'd have to undress the body, which would be incredibly dishonoring because Jews would never see nakedness, and so they'd have to undress the body. And then what's even more crazy is we know this from Jewish burial practices that you would wrap the body with clothes and you pour all this myrrh on it. And when you put myrrh on cloth, it becomes like glue. It like sticks to the dead body to keep the smells inside. But the story is that the clothes were in the grave. And so somehow they'd have to unpeel all of these clothes that are stuck to the body like glue in the midst of a Roman guard outside. Just strains imagination that the disciples could pull something off like this. That is a wilder theory than that Jesus actually rose from the dead. Because there's only one explanation that makes sense of all the data, is that Jesus wasn't just a human who died on a Roman cross. That he was God, who death could not keep down. And that 3 days later, that Sunday morning, he walked out of that tomb. A violent earthquake shook the thing. The rock rolled out, and Jesus resurrected through his grave clothes. New resurrection body that will last forever. He walked out of that tomb 3 days after he died. Why am I a Christian? It's this. Jesus rose from the dead. This is the foundation, because the resurrection is not just an event in history. It's not just something cool that happened a long, long time ago. Because the promise of the resurrection is that all the promises Jesus said are true as well. And the biggest promise that Jesus made is not only that he resurrects, but that he will resurrect his people as well. One of the most incredible verses in the Bible, John 11:25-26. Jesus said, "I am the resurrection and the life. The one who believes in me will live, even though they die. And whoever lives by believing in me will never die." Do you believe this? That is the question that is held out for history, for every single person who's ever come after the resurrection, is that Jesus said, "I am the resurrection. I am going to rise again. And if you believe in me, I will do the same for you." That is the ultimate promise. And what we love about Christianity, we're not just waiting for the end. We're not just supposed to spend this life looking forward to some moment, great moment in the future. It's that resurrection life starts now. The moment we put our faith in Jesus, that there is a way to live now that is not just in accordance with truth. It's not just a wise and good way to live that brings about good things in this life. It is the way that we were made to live in service to Jesus. The upside down kingdom, the upside down walk of putting others before ourselves, to follow in the footsteps of Jesus in service and sacrifice, is the best way to live in a way that will transform the culture around us. We follow Jesus wherever he leads because he rose from the dead. Because he rose from the dead, we can trust everything that he says. Everything that Ken mentioned last week, what's the giant stamp of validation on what we looked at last week? It's the resurrection, that God has come to lead us to eternal life. And so the resurrection forces this question on us. Will we follow our resurrection King? And this morning, we're going to wrap up here, and so I'm going to call the worship team up, and we're going to take communion in a second. But I think it's so important to pursue truth. That's why I'm preaching like this. This minimal facts argument, it's a great argument. It gives me confidence. It's such a great way to talk to others about Jesus. But it's not just head knowledge. Head knowledge is important. We're supposed to love our God with our minds, for sure. We're supposed to love our God with our heart, soul, and strength as well. And so my prayer is this morning that hopefully this does strengthen your mind. It gives you confidence. It helps give you assurance in your faith. But I don't just want to leave it there, because it's so important, not just that we know head knowledge, as important as it is. It's important that we follow the resurrection King ourselves. And so I share all of this morning to make Jesus more beautiful, because he is beautiful. To make the resurrection life more tangible, because what Jesus showed us that Sunday morning in AD 33 is the same promise for each and every one of us. And that's what we're trying to do as a church. That's why everything that we do in the worship that we sing, in the Bible studies, and all the sermons, and all the conversations, and all the eating together, whatever it is for this purpose of how do we, in every area of our life, walk faithfully Jesus. in our minds, in our hearts, in our service, in our worship, in our inner life, in our external life. Every part of us wants to know this King who resurrected. So if worship team wants to come up, we'll transition to a time of communion. And I didn't have a place for this in my sermon, and I was like, I'll just talk about the communion time. Because what's really fascinating is that we do know, well, we're very confident we know where the tomb is of Jesus, but there's no veneration of that site. And this is incredible to me. I mean, think about it. When a very famous person dies, their tomb is decorated. Their followers will remember it for a very long time. But there is zero evidence that the followers of Jesus did anything with the tomb after Jesus rose from the dead, because he wasn't there. They didn't care to venerate a site because that's not where their God was. And so unlike every other famous historical person, the graveside was not marked and displayed. You have to travel to it to see it as a holy site. It was just, yeah, that's the tomb. We know where it is. But Jesus is alive and well, so there's no point to venerate the gravesite. And we celebrate in communion the death of our King. And normally when you talk about the death of the most person you love more than anything else, it usually brings sadness. But again, not in Christianity. That the word that the church has used a lot for communion is the Eucharist, which means to give thanks. That what's so ironic is that we are celebrating and giving thanks for a death. And the only reason we can do that is because he didn't stay dead.